You're listening to Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moscoane. Many critics consider Salman Rushdie's 1981 book Midnight's Children to be among the best novels ever written. But it was his 1988 book The Satanic Verses that changed his life forever. When Iran's supreme leader issued a fatwa calling for Rushdie's death based on his depiction of the prophet Muhammad. Rushdie lived for nearly a decade under a British security detail until the Iranian state called off its assassins in 1998. He published a memoir in 2012 recounting his experiences and titled it Joseph Anton. It was based on an alias he went by in those years, a combination of his two favorite writers, Joseph Conrad and Anton Chekhov. Our show today is based on our conversation in 2013, when Rushdie's fear of the fatwa had subsided. It's an interesting look at his mindset at the time. Things, though, changed again in 2022, when Rushdie was attacked on stage at a literary event by a young man motivated by the fatwa. Rushdie was stabbed several times and lost sight in one eye and narrowly survived a brutal murder attempt. Knowing how things played out gives our interview here an added dimension. We start with Rushdie reading from the first paragraph of his 2012 memoir.
This is how it begins. Afterwards, when the world was exploding around him and the lethal blackbirds were massing on the climbing frame in the school playground, he felt annoyed with himself for forgetting the name of the BBC reporter, a woman, who had told him that his old life was over and a new, darker existence was about to begin. She had called him at home on his private line without explaining how she got the number. "How does it feel," she asked him, "to know that you have just been sentenced to death by the Ayatollah Khomeini?" It was a sunny Tuesday in London, but the question shut out the light. This is what he said, without really knowing what he was saying. "It doesn't feel good." This is what he thought. "I'm a dead man." He wondered how many days he had left to live and thought the answer was probably a single-digit number. He put down the telephone and ran down the stairs from his workroom at the top of the narrow Islington row house where he lived. The living room windows had wooden shutters, and absurdly he closed and barred them. Then he locked the front door.
And that's Salman Rushdie reading from the very beginning of his memoir called Joseph Anton. And I have to say, because you refer to yourself in the third person, I had to keep orienting myself. Was Joseph Anton, did that feel like someone different from Salman Rushdie, and that's why he's a he and not an I?
In a way, yes. I mean, first of all, that was a much younger self. You know, I mean, this happened to me when I was 41 years old. You know, it's a quarter of a century ago. And so there's that. And also, you know, that younger self was innocent of everything that happened to me afterwards, you know. So he is, it's a sort of simpler person, you know, without the burden of experience that he then acquired, you know. So, yeah, I wanted to say that the me writing the book is a slightly different person than the me being written about, you know, partly because of being older, partly because of all that experience, and partly because of being in a better place in my life, you know, being able to reflect in tranquility and write about it calmly.
Your minders, if I can call that, they called you Joe, which you did not appreciate. Joseph Anton, they referred to you as Joe.
Yes, it was bad enough having to have a pseudonym, but to have a diminutive of the pseudonym. I don't know, there are friends of mine who say that that's kind of ridiculous. Why does it matter which one it is? But it sort of did.
But as you read there, and as we certainly know about you, you lived under the threat of a death sentence for about 9 years.
Yeah, or even more, really. But it was, you know, a lot of people, particularly in England, began to feel that because I hadn't been killed, that nobody had been trying to kill me, you know, that it was all exaggerated. But the fact is, first of all, that it wasn't only I who was threatened, you know, I mean, the publishers of the novel, its translators, etc., were under threat in many countries, and there were attacks. You
know, in fact, a translator was killed.
The Japanese translator, Professor Igarashi, was murdered at his college late one night when he was working late. The Italian translator was seriously attacked and was very lucky to survive. And my Norwegian publisher, William Nygaard, was shot three times in the back and survived by a miracle. You know, so And as you know, there were attacks on bookstores around the world, including here in the United States. You know, I mean, Cody's bookstore in Berkeley was pipe bombed. You know, there were firebombs in other places too. It was a very, very real attack.
Did you feel, though, during that time, I mean, did you have not regret so much, but a sense of responsibility? As you said, I mean, people paid, in certain cases, almost with in one case, with his life.
Well, you can't help feeling, you know, that if friends and colleagues of yours are being threatened and attacked, you know, you can't help feeling responsible. But I remember very well when William Nygaard, my Norwegian publisher, had recovered sufficiently from the wounds for me to be able to speak to him on the phone. The first thing he said to me was, "This is not your fault." He said, "You know," he said, "I'm a perfectly grown-up person. I knew what I was doing when I published your book. I'm very proud to be the publisher." You know, and then in true heroic publisher style, he said, "By the way, we've just ordered a very large reprint." And I thought, to say that from your hospital bed when you've got three bullet holes in you is a genuinely courageous act.
You know? Do you think the critics, did they understand the book or did they misunderstand the book?
Well, many people didn't read it. Many people were just pointed in a certain direction by extremist priests and just believed what they were being told and went that way. I mean, I've had, there are one or two cases I quote in the book of people much later who had been involved in the protests coming up to me and saying that they had since then had actually read the book and they couldn't see what the fuss was about, even though they had been the people making the fuss. You know, so that was frustrating. I mean, I think what's fair to say is that the relatively short part of the Satanic Verses that deals with this material in a dream sequence is, if you like, a kind of dissident view of the birth of a religion, because I'm not a religious person. So I'm looking at religion and the phenomenon of revelation from the point of view from someone who's skeptical about it. And I guess there are people who don't like that.
Mm. But you also seem to say that Khomeini was using this fatwa for his own political purposes Iran.
I don't think that's even really in dispute anymore. I mean, this was not long after Iran's Iraq war had ended in a kind of debacle. And the revolution was probably in more trouble than it's ever been, you know, since it happened. And he was looking for a way to rally the troops, you know, and it was just as my bad luck to be Khomeini's last stand.
Right. A sort of a diversion for him.
A diversion for him in a way of kind of re-energizing the faithful. And that, unfortunately, turned out to be me.
I got the feeling that, and I don't want to go too much out on a limb on this, is that this fatwa was the beginning of extremist acts. I'm not saying it led to 9/11, but there might be a circuitous path from this fatwa to, you know, something like 9/11.
I think there's pretty much a straight line. You know, actually, I mean, one of the things that I try and show in the book is how that line goes. You know, that something which began as what seemed like a bizarre, marginal, kind of one-off, weird thing, you know, which didn't seem to be symbolic of any larger project, you know, how we gradually can see how that project enlarged, you know, and I think I came to think that what happened to me was a kind of prologue, you know, and yes, the 9/11 attack was the main event, if you like, you know, but you can, I think, see the growth of that kind of malevolent, kind of medievalist assault using modern technology. You know, how it grew during those years. Many other people were attacked all over the world, and then climaxing in this terrible event in America.
Is it sort of strange to think that you were so well guarded during this difficult time? I mean, yes, you certainly lived under the threat of death, but you also were surrounded by guards who moved you from place to place.
Well, the British Special Branch, they're very, not only are they very good at their job, they're actually very proud of their success rate, because as they would tell me, and actually it was very comforting to hear, that in all the time they had protected people, they had never lost anyone. So they had 100% success rate. And they were rather scornful of the Americans. They said, if you look at the Americans, they have far more manpower, far more resources, but you know, they lost one president, they had another one hit, that has not happened to us. You know, that we have never lost anybody. And I wanted very much that they should keep their 100% record.
Which clearly they did.
Which they did.
But you have to, I guess, learn to live with people that are, what, sitting in your kitchen?
Yeah.
Sitting
yeah.
In the car with you?
I mean, I think it's the, you know, I talked in the, over those years, I met with, you know, a lot of people, politicians and so on, who received this kind of protection. The thing that everyone said is the two hardest things to deal with are the loss of privacy, you know, because you have strangers in your home.
All the time.
All the time, day and night, and the loss of spontaneity. So it means you can't do anything on the spur of the moment. You know, if I'm writing a book and I'm feeling stale and, you know, I need to freshen my head and I want to go for a walk, I would have to say that. And they would say, okay, well, just give us an hour and a half and we'll set it up and you can go for a walk.
Wow.
And I would think, I don't want to go for a walk in an hour and a half. I want to go for a walk now. An hour and a half from now, I want to be working again. You know, and that is literally everybody who's ever had this experience says that those two things, privacy, spontaneity, those are the hardest things to lose.
You do write with some degree of honesty about the stresses on your family,
yeah.
On your children, certainly. You've had four wives. I mean, it seems that it's been difficult to hold a family together under these circumstances.
Well, it was very hard to be a father, that's for sure. You know, I mean, my older son was not even 10 years old when this happened. So in many ways, this happened to him too, and he was a child.
You know? And he was living with his mom, right?
He was living with his mom, but you know, she and I had to very carefully shepherd him through this, you know, and I think actually he came through it incredibly well. He was really, you know, his school was incredibly supportive. His friends were very supportive. I mean, this was a collective act, you know. I mean, I wouldn't be sitting here in reasonable shape if it weren't for the support of people who cared about me, you know, my friends and family. And we were all trying to help each other through it, but it took a lot of doing.
But it seemed that also writing stories for your son helped you as a writer, maybe as a father as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I think it helped all of that, yeah. Because, I mean, I had promised him that I'd write a book that he would enjoy, you know.
it's a nice gift for a son,
yeah,
isn't it?
Why don't you write books that I want to read, Dad, you know? and I thought, good question, you know. And so I thought that when this started and we, you know, our family life was very disrupted, I thought that's at least something I can do, you know, for him and with him. And that became Haroon and the Sea of Stories, which, I mean, strangely, given that this was maybe the worst year of my life, it's my happiest book.
Is it?
You know, it's the most cheerful, optimistic. It's the first book I wrote which has a, like, fully-fledged happy ending, you know. And I guess I was really interested in happy endings at that moment. And, of course, in making him feel happy. You know, so it's an incredibly upbeat book written at a very dark time.
I'd love to have you read another section, and this is just, these are about the armed guards, I guess the changing of the guards.
Yes, I mean, it's, who knew that I would end up with so many close friends in the British Secret Police, but I mean, it's true. There had been a change of protection team. Stan, Benny, Dennis and Mick had gone back to their families, and he was now in the care of Dev Stonehouse, a character with a face suffused by the colour of what looked like a drinking problem, full of scurrilous, loose-tongued tales about other principals he had taken care of. The night the Irish politician Jerry Fitt drank 16 gin and tonics, the intolerably high-handed behaviour of the minister Tom King towards his prot team. That chap might get a bullet put in his back one of these days. And by contrast, the gentlemanly behaviour of the firebrand Ulsterman Ian Paisley, who remembered everyone's names, asked about their families, and prayed with his protection officers at the start of every day. In Dev's team were two more smiling, gentle-natured drivers, Alex and Phil, who turned a deaf ear to Dev spouting his nonsense, and a second protection officer, Peter Huddle, who clearly loathed Detective Sergeant Stonehouse. "He's like hemorrhoids," he said loudly in the kitchen, "a royal pain in the ass."
I mean, it sounds kind of comedic and fun and maybe funny. And
well, one of the things you learn if you hang around with policemen is a very kind of strange strain of police humor. You know, I mean, for instance, there was one of the drivers, actually one of those guys, had the nickname of the King of Spain. And the reason he was called the King of Spain is that he'd once neglected his armored car briefly and it got stolen while he wasn't looking. And he was called the King of Spain because if you say the name of the King of Spain slowly, it's Juan Carlos.
Oh. So, and these are the people that have 100% protection.
These were,
security,
you know, these, yes, with people with incredible shooting skills and, you know, having to go through all kinds of training procedures and then pass the tests again every few months to give them the right to retain their firearms and so on. So they were highly skilled people.
But did you learn any sort of getaway skills?
Yes,
or?
Yes.
You did?
Yeah, I mean, I know exactly now. I know a lot about what's called counter-surveillance. You know, that's to say, if you're driving around and you want to see if you're being followed, you know, I mean, I can do that for you.
You want to share that?
Well, some of it, it depends if you're driving in a city or if you're driving on a freeway. If you're driving in the city, basically, well, here, because you drive on the right, you basically have to make a lot of turns across the stream of traffic. You know, so you make a lot of left turns. And if something else is making all those left turns, there's probably only one reason.
Oh.
You know, you do silly things. You go around roundabouts twice. You know, and if somebody else is doing it, they're probably following you. I mean, there's little. You know, basically, you drive badly, and if anybody else is driving badly in the same way, that's probably why.
I learned something today.
And if you're on a freeway, it's different because everybody's going the same way all the time. What you do there, for example, is you randomly vary your speed. So you slow down to 40 miles an hour, you speed up to 110 miles an hour, and you do that completely randomly. You know, and so if anyone else is doing that, I mean, they're either insane or they're following you. And the other thing you do is as you approach an exit, you get into the exit lane and you drive very fast. Now, at that point, if somebody's following you, they don't know if you're going off or not, you know, so they have to do what you're doing in order to stay with you. So these are some of the tricks.
Have you ever had to use those skills yourself?
No, but I mean, I know how to do it. The technical name for this is called dry cleaning.
Kind of like the King of Spain.
Yeah, this is called, if you want to dry clean the principal, you know, you have to do this to make sure that he can safely go where he has to go.
This seems like there's a book in here, just the sort of cop part of your life under the fatwa.
Yeah, well,
I mean, it's clearly in this book.
A lot of it is in here, but I mean, also, this is just the ordinary policing stuff, but I've now also learned quite a lot about intelligence work, you know, and I think I could probably write not a bad spy novel, you know, maybe I should. I mean, I had a few meetings, you know, in that James Bond building on the river with Judi Dench inside.
Oh, sure.
You know, and I'm able to tell you that the head of British intelligence is not called M. He is, however, called C.
Why?
And responsible for control, I suppose. You know, but I mean,
M would be mother, right?
M would be, well, M was just, Ian Fleming picked it out of the alphabet, you know. And in fact, at some of the time that I was in this situation, the head of intelligence was, in fact, a woman, you know, and super intelligent and ferocious, you know, and very, I mean, I actually became very impressed by these people. I felt that British intelligence was unusually good at its job and very serious and completely no nonsense, you know. And they would tell me only the minimum. They would tell me what I needed to know, and they would protect their sources and so on. So I remember one moment when they were telling me about a particular threat, which was, they alleged, quite serious, and they wouldn't give me any details about how they knew. And so I said, look, since we're talking about my life, I think you owe it to me to give me some more background on this, you know. And the intelligence officer leaned across the table, rather like you and I right now. He leaned across the table, looked me right in the eye, and said, no.
They're like father to son,
yeah,
right? Just,
yeah. I said, oh, you mean no? And he said, yes. I mean, no.
End of discussion.
I said, okay, I can deal with that.
That's Salman Rushdie, our guest today on Radio Times. His latest book, a memoir called Joseph Anton, is out in paperback. You do write about, I know you were very, very good friends with Christopher Hitchens, who died recently from cancer, and friends with Martin Amis and others as well. But you do write about the importance of friendship when you're living under such dire circumstances.
I mean, I think it's the reason I survived. You know, is that the people who cared for me really showed up when they needed to. You know, and I think it's It was an extraordinary demonstration of the fact that my friends were really true friends, you know. And I mean, I remember many people who weren't particularly close to me saying, you know, was this a time when people were frightened to be near you and but people were sort of backing away? But actually what happened to me was the opposite, that people came closer. And Christopher was one of those. I mean, Christopher had been a friend of mine before this happened, but became much closer during this time because he wanted to be of service. You know, he wanted to, he really came, you know, and he's a hell of a soldier to have beside you in a battle.
Sure, and a good conversationalist on top of
it. Yes, but you want Christopher on your side.
Yes, you do.
You don't want him on the other side. And he was also just, I mean, I think in a way what many of us, as you said, Martin Amis, Ian McEwan, James Fenton, those of us who were his close friends, what we miss is the fun of Christopher, you know, because everybody knows about his kind of political attack dog side. But he was one of the funniest people I ever knew. And that's, it's almost unbelievable to think we won't have those evenings anymore.
But, and we're talking about Christopher Hitchens, who died a year or so ago, actually wrote a beautiful book about death, about dying. It was just, you know, just...
Well, that was part of his courage, that he was going to face this thing,
documented,
but just
us.
By looking it right in the face,
yes.
You know, and talking about it. I mean, I remember he would say, people talk about how you have to fight cancer. And he said, you know, it doesn't feel like a fight. You know, it feels like you're just sitting here while stuff is done to you, you know, and while the illness has its way with you.
Yeah.
You know, but I think he actually did find a way to fight it. You know, he fought it with words.
Indeed. Were your friends able to come and be with you? I mean, did they have to get through your guards?
In the early days, it was impossible. I was just, you know, sequestered from almost everything. And there were very occasional moments when I could be driven somewhere and people who were close to me would also drive there, and there would be all kinds of cloak and daggerish stuff for me to spend an evening with a couple of people. And that included to spend time with my son. But as things went on, yeah, I think that what happened is that the police, who were initially very distrustful of everybody, including my friends, gradually began to see that my friends had actually been very helpful and had been very loyal and were people that could be trusted. And at that point, yes, people were sort of allowed into the circle.
Did you have to wear disguises?
No. I mean, unfortunately, I look like this. It's difficult
to leave it, right?
Yeah, it's difficult to disguise that.
But it sounds like you I don't know if depression is too strong a word, but you certainly were feeling pretty blue and, I guess, disconnected from your family, from the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I kept a journal throughout these years. And one of the quite shocking things to me, going back and reading the journal, is that, you know, I had expected it to read like a diary of what happened, you know, but actually what it showed me was what a bad frame of mind I'd been in a lot of the time. You know, so the person writing the journal was clearly not okay, you know, a lot of the time. And that meant that when I came to write this book, the journal was, in a way, it was a lot of use because it told me what happened when, you know. But it wasn't much use in that there were not really passages in it that I could lift out and put in this book. Because really what it did was to show me the state of mind I was in. And then allow me now to write about myself then in that state of mind, you know. But yeah, I mean, it was unimaginable pressure. And I mean, I hope that nobody listening to this ever has to imagine it.
That was novelist Salman Rushdie speaking with me in 2013. In just a moment, we'll be back with more Radio Times Rewind as Rushdie comments on his father's alcoholism, his Twitter spat with Jonathan Franzen, and his critique of identity politics.
It seems as if there's a project amongst many groups to try and prevent the expression of things that they don't like.
This is Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's get back to my 2013 interview with novelist Salman Rushdie. Rushdie was born in India to a Muslim family and moved to England for boarding school at the age of 13. Since the year 2000, he's lived in the United States. We resume the conversation here with more about his upbringing.
One thing I was interested to learn a little bit about your childhood, your growing up, about your father and your mother. Your father actually changed the family's name to Rushdie.
Yeah.
And which seems like a very American thing to do. I mean, people come to this country and change their name.
Exactly.
Cohen was not the name that my husband's family had at all when they arrived in Ellis Island.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think he just decided that he wanted a modern-sounding, you know, surname as opposed to the old-fashioned way of naming children in certainly in Muslim families in India, where there isn't really a permanent surname. You take your father's last name, first name as your last name. And he didn't want to do that. He wanted to have like a modern last surname, you know. And so he chose Rushdie because he was a great admirer of the 12th century Spanish Arab philosopher Ibn Rushd, known as Averroes in the West, great commentator on Aristotle, great rationalist and humanist, you know. And oddly, of course, Ibn Rushd, when I read about him, in the 12th century, was involved in himself in a battle against the fundamentalists of his day, you know, who disapproved of him for being too interested in things like reason and logic. You know, and he went through a period of being sent into exile and having his books burned and so on and so on. And eventually, at the end of his life, he was rehabilitated and so on. But, you know, I thought, boy, did my father choose the right name.
I'll say.
You know.
I'll say. What would your name have been if it hadn't been Salman Rushdie?
Well, my father's first name was Anis. So I would have been Salman Anis. Then my son would have been, you know, Zafar or Milan Salman. And their sons would take their first name as the last name. And that's obviously in the kind of modern world, that's really difficult.
Very confusing.
Doesn't work, you know. So
you write about your mother and about something called her forgettery.
Yeah.
I mean, that we talk about memory, but she did something called a forgettery. And it sounds like your parents didn't have a very happy marriage.
Well, it's a strange thing because they obviously deeply loved each other. That's without question. But my father developed, as the years went on, quite a serious drinking problem.
Uh-huh.
And I think that made a lot of trouble in the marriage. And my mother used to say, she said, you know, my way of handling it is I forget every day what happened the day before. You know,
how do you do that?
I you know, because she had a forgettery instead of a memory, she said. And she had just trained herself every day to say, it's a fresh day, it's a new day. Never mind what happened yesterday, today is today. And I mean, it's, you know, it's a kind of, it's sad. I mean,
it is sad.
It suggests a sad life, you know.
Meaning that, I mean, she literally just forgot
Just put it away. Because, I mean, he would, you know, he was an angry drunk. You know, there are some people who get maudlin and sentimental and affectionate when they're drunk. But he got mean.
Oh.
You know? And we all knew it as children that the person he was in the daytime was one person who was very lovable, actually, very charming and interesting and smart and so on. And then in the evening, you know, look out.
Did he hit you? Or
no, no, no. He was just, but he was angry a lot. And so, you know, as kids, it was easier for us to just keep out of his way,
right.
You know. But my mother couldn't do that, you know. Uh-huh. So in many ways, she was taking the brunt of it to shield us.
You also went to a British boarding school, and it's always shocking to me when you find out that an 11-year-old is in a boarding school. It just seems so...
Well, it wasn't 11, it was 13.
13, but still,
still,
it seems
young, yeah,
still
no,
a
I mean,
child.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, to be fair to my parents, I was the one who said I wanted to go. You know,
want to get out of the house?
In part, yeah. But I mean, you know, my mother didn't want me to go, my father said, it's your decision, and I said... Yes, I'll go, you know. But I didn't know what I was letting myself in for. I mean, I had a very idealized, sort of romantic idea of English boarding schools. I mean, it's as if, you know, it's like Harry Potter without the magic, you know. but where there were these kind of cool places where people had adventures and things like that. And when I arrived there, that was really not what it was like.
Well, in fact, you said you had three strikes against you. You were foreign, you were smart,
and bad at sports.
And bad at sports.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's the triple whammy.
So were you the kid in the library while everyone else on the soccer field?
I sort of was, yes. I mean, I always was a big reader. And in a way, I thought, you know, my way of getting my revenge on these creeps was to outdo them in class. You know, so that's what I did.
Yeah.
I was very studious, and I'm afraid good.
You were a good student.
I was a good kid.
Oh, a good kid.
I didn't misbehave. I wasn't naughty. I mean, I was so boring.
And you regret that now?
Well, my sister was the naughty one, and she had all the fun.
Oh. But you wanted to be a good boy.
I was a ridiculously good boy. And in fact, I remember soon after the fatwa, you know, they found my old English teacher, now retired and elderly, you know, and they interviewed him, and he said, who'd have thought such a nice, quiet boy would get into so much trouble?
I saw a quote about, and this is about the satanic verses, and about you saying, you say, it's not an evil book, and I'm a good person.
Yeah, this is you know, there's a section in the memoir which I call the trap of wanting to be loved. And I think the problem is we're all guilty of that. You know, we all want people to think well of us. We all want to be the good guy. And certainly when this trouble started, there was a bit of me which thought, if I could just explain it to people, they will understand that they've made a mistake, you know, and then we can all be reasonable and shake hands and get on with our day. And that was
naive, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a delusion, you know, and it was, I think, very, in a way, helpful to me to lose that idea that if I just say the right thing, everybody will love me, you know. And I thought, well, these people who aren't going to love me, well, you know, it's okay because I'm not that wild about them either.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, wanted to know if you knew a fatwa was a possibility, would you write the satanic verses any differently?
This is the question I've probably been asked once a week for 25 years.
I figured.
And I think the answer is yes, because I'm actually very proud of that novel. I mean, I think it was very close to being the best novel I ever wrote. I mean, it's certainly, in my view, one of the best. And what I like is that now that the fuss has died down, is that finally a lot of people are reading it, you know, just as a novel instead of as a hot potato. And a lot of people like it, you know. And my view is I don't see why the opinion of the people who like it matters less than the opinion of the people who didn't read it and didn't like it, you know. So I think maybe it's time that the people who like the book have their turn.
You write at the very end of the book, and it seems like when the fatwa is lifted or you feel safe enough to live in the world, you're no longer Joseph Anton. You're now Salman Rushdie.
Yes, I was very happy.
Did it feel like I'm sort of shedding this identity?
I hated having that. I mean, one of the reasons I made it the title of the book is just to dramatize for people how weird it is to be asked to give up your name.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very weird thing. It's one thing, you know, there are writers who want pseudonyms and so on and like to, but I was never a writer of that kind. But in your personal life, to be asked for security reasons to give up your own name, it's a bizarre thing. Yeah. And I thought it would, in a way, dramatize the bizarreness of those years if that was the title. Joseph Anton, a memoir, it ends up being me, you know. It's
especially
odd.
Written in the third person.
Yeah. So the day I could lay him to rest was a happy day. Yeah.
Are you still friends with your guards or some of the guards
about? Some of them, yes. In fact, when we had the book publication for the memoir in England, I invited a lot of them, and a lot of them came.
Hmm.
You know, and now they because they were off duty, they could drink, which they couldn't back then.
Did they call you Joe?
They tried very hard. They almost did, actually. I saw it beginning to slip out of their minds, but they controlled themselves.
I saw something that you said this summer that really interested me. It was that actually at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, you said, I do think that one of the characteristics of our age is the growth of this culture of offendedness. It has to do with the rise of identity politics, whether you're invited to define your identity quite narrowly, you know, Western, Islamic, whatever it might be. But I was interested in this culture of offendedness.
I mean, I think it's a very worrying thing that people seem to feel that their identity is best expressed by the things they are against, you know, the things that upset them or annoy them or allegedly insult or offend them, you know. And because, of course, if you were to use that really as a guiding principle, everything offends somebody.
Of course.
You know, and it means there would be no books in the bookstores, there'd be no movies in the movie theaters, you know, nobody would be able to speak, you know. And in any kind of genuinely free society, we just deal with the fact that people are going to say things, write things, you know, make movies that we don't like, you know, and you just have to deal with it. But now it seems as if there's a project amongst many groups to try and prevent the expression of things that they don't like, you know, and that's, of course, in a country which prides itself on the First Amendment, that's a big problem.
Do you think it also, I mean, as you were talking about talking that way, I was thinking about just how the social the Twitterverse, for instance, is just alive with people slamming other people. You get to be anonymous in certain ways. It allows people to be more offended offensive.
Yeah, I do think that the anonymity question is quite a problem, because you're quite right. It allows people to be rude, discourteous, in a way that they would not be if their name was known and they were sitting in the room with you.
Right.
You know, and I worry that it's bringing up generation after generation of people who think it's okay to be viciously rude without any excuse or justification, just because you feel like it, because you're trolling somebody, you know. And on the other hand, of course, there are people who defend the anonymity by saying that, particularly in countries where there are authoritarian regimes or whatever, that the anonymity allows the public to protest.
Sure.
You know,
look at Iran a couple of years ago.
Iran, Egypt, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a thorny question. But there's no doubt that sometimes there's an advantage in the anonymity. But sometimes, yes, it leads to kind of colossal rudeness of a kind that's worrying.
Does anything offend you?
Oh, lots of things offend me. You know, the novels of Dan Brown. But I think he should probably live.
And that's the difference, right?
And that's the difference, yeah.
But do you think it's come down to that?
No, I mean, I think it's, you know, I hope that some of this tide, I mean, these things are cyclical, you know. And I know that, for instance, a lot of the people who protested against the Satanic Verses 25 years ago now publicly say that they regret it, that they thought it was a mistake. You know, some of them think it's a mistake for tactical reasons, which is they said, oh, it just made him more famous and sold more of his books.
And there's some truth to that, isn't
there? There is some truth to that. And some of them feel it was a mistake because they've, in a way, accepted the free speech argument, which is that if they get to say what they want to say, people who disagree with them must also be allowed to say what they want to say.
One of the arguments is that some people have more free speech than others. And by that, I mean, if you're Dan Brown or perhaps Salman Rushdie, chances are you have a bigger audience for your speech.
No question. No question. But I mean, I think here is one of the things that the First Amendment really gets right. It's better to allow unpleasant things to be said than to prevent difficult things from being expressed. You know, so the rule is everything's allowed. And I mean, I must say, it's worrying when you see some of the ugliness that is expressed in the name of free speech. You know, but the problem is, how do you start silencing it? Who decides where the limit is? And if you're going to err in one direction or the other, I think to err in the direction of too much freedom is better than erring in the direction of too little.
Let me get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have looks like Diane from South Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Diane, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Rushdie, in addition to yourself, I was a very big fan of Bruce Chatwin.
Yes.
And I remember reading that you, in fact, while you were in seclusion, went to his funeral.
Yes.
And I just wanted to commend you on that, because it's just a sign of true friendship that you took that chance.
Oh, thank you. That was actually the day. It was the same day as the Khomeini attack. So, yeah, it was just I just thought, the hell with it. You know, he's my friend. I'm going to his memorial service.
Diane, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
I mean, one of the things I felt actually writing this book is how many people I've known during this time when I was supposed to be the target, you know, who died too young.
Yeah.
You know, Bruce Chatwin, Raymond Carver, Angela Carter, Christopher Hitchens, you know, people in the prime of their lives. You know, it just goes to show, you know, a fatwa isn't the only way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sometimes it's just cancer or AIDS.
Does it make you think you're lucky?
Well, it makes me feel a little bit like a survivor, you know.
Yes.
I mean, it's I got through it.
Yeah.
So far.
Do you have survivor's guilt?
No, I feel just fine, thank you.
But you said you got through it so far.
Well, nobody gets out alive, do they?
No, they don't. No, they don't. I wasn't sure exactly where you were going with that. Do you have any feelings about Iran?
No, I mean, what I remember is when I was very young, when I was 21, I just graduated from college, I actually drove across the world from England to India with a friend. You know, a thing you can't do anymore. The world was different then. Yeah. We drove through Iran. We drove through Afghanistan. Try doing it now.
Yes, exactly.
But it meant that I actually spent a month or so traveling in Iran, and I loved it. You know, and I thought it's extraordinarily beautiful. The people were deeply cultured and very welcoming, and I had a great time there. And I've always felt that this tyranny that it has taken hold in Iran, what a crime it is that it should happen to those people, you know, because they were maybe some of the most cultured, the most, you know, broad-minded, the most progressive people in the whole of the region, you know. And so I just hope for their sake that they get their country back.
Do you think of, I know you're a big movie fan, do you think of the possibility of this memoir being a movie?
Well, there's somebody wants to do it. We're talking, really? we're having, as they say, talks.
Oh.
Yeah. And then everybody says, who do you want to play you?
Of course.
I made the mistake when talking to a British tabloid journalist who asked me this question. I said, well, obviously it should be Johnny Depp because of the strong physical resemblance. You know? And the next day, the newspaper ran this article saying Salman Rushdie thinks he looks like Johnny Depp. You know, so it just taught me don't make jokes to tabloid journalists.
No, exactly. Exactly. You are a big movie buff, and yeah. I guess grew up, it sounds like, just in Bombay.
Yes, right? Which is a huge movie. I mean, Bombay is like, if Los Angeles and New York were the same city,
yes.
You know, if Hollywood was in Manhattan, you know, it would be like that. So if you grow up there, you grow up with the movies engulfing you everywhere, movies being shot on every street corner, you know. And I had, you know, I had an uncle who wrote scripts for the movies. I had two aunts who appeared in movies. And so, yes, you grow up with the movies as part of, you know, your consciousness. And then I feel that when I was a young man, when I was at Cambridge, this was just one of the great moments in the history of world cinema, you know. And I think it's very hard for people now to grasp how impressive it was to be going to the movies to see what are now considered to be the classics when they were the new movies. What's this week's new movie? Oh, it's La Dolce Vita.
Oh, gosh, you know? Yes.
And so on. You know, every week there was what now we think of as a classic was that week's new release. And I feel that I got as much of my education in the movie theater as in the library.
Do you still go to the movies or do you do the Netflix thing?
No, I like going to movie theaters. Yeah. I do. I think because I also think there's a difference in the collective act of viewing. You know,
I agree.
Particularly for comedy, you know, it's very difficult to look at even a really funny film at home and roll around laughing. You somehow need everybody else to be laughing too.
Do you talk in the movies?
I do not. I'm fantastically.
That was a very loaded question, I have to tell you.
I'm very, very purist.
Me too.
Yes.
Right. No talking.
No. Shut up.
I know that you wrote the screenplay for Midnight's Children. Well, I mean, what was that like for you to? Because the screenplay is so different
I mean, I think, you know, I think the reason I felt able to do it is because the book is quite a while ago. You know, because it's a book I wrote, you know, 30 years ago. I could revisit it from a different point in my writing life and see what I thought of it. Yeah. And I could actually probably be more disrespectful to it than anybody else. You know, I'm the one who could rip it apart, you know. And I think what's interesting is that the movie, I like the movie. Deepa Mehta directed it. I think it came out pretty well. I think it has a slightly different tone of voice than the book.
Yeah.
You know, the book is, I think, wilder and crazier and funnier, maybe, more surrealist. The movie is more emotional. You know, I don't think a lot of people weep when they read Midnight's Children, but a lot of people wept when they saw the movie. And I kind of like that. Yeah. Making people cry, it's good.
And indeed it is. And you did the voiceover, or you were
at the end, I did. I mean, I wasn't planning to, but in the end, it didn't work with the people that Deepa tried casting to do it. You know, she wasn't happy with it. And then she said, look, you know, you wrote the book, you should do this. And twisted my arm until I agreed.
Did you enjoy that?
In the end, I did. I was very nervous for a while because one of the things I think about the film is that it's beautifully cast. I think really the performances are exceptional. And I didn't want to be the worst actor in the movie. So I was quite nervous about it. But in the end, I mean, now I think it's all right. I mean, I'm okay with it.
I ran across a little Twitter war between you and Jonathan Franzen. And Jonathan Franzen said, I confess to feeling some version of his disappointment when a novelist who I believe ought to have known better, Salman Rushdie, succumbs to Twitter. But you certainly put him in his place.
I just thought, leave me alone, you know? I understand what he's saying, you know? I can see how Jonathan wants nothing to do with it, you know, and feels that it kind of, it's noise that he doesn't need in his head, you know? Fair enough. You know? And it's entirely his right, A, to feel that way, and B, to express those feelings. But, you know, leave me out of it. I mean, if I have a different point of view, and by the way, many, many writers have a different point of view. You know, Margaret Atwood uses it a lot. Joyce Carol Oates uses it a lot. And so I could name 100. And the point is, none of us use it that much. You know, I mean, if there's sometimes weeks will go by where I don't do anything on Twitter. But sometimes I think of it as being useful or valuable, or sometimes I even think of it as being fun, you know. And I think, mind your own business.
Well, I think you told him to go back into his ivory tower or something like that.
Well, it's just that, you know, I've got, you know, Gary Steingart, Nathan Englander. I mean, lots and lots of people enjoy it, you know, so leave us alone in our playground.
That was my 2013 interview with novelist Salman Rushdie. Well, joining me now in studio is WHYY executive producer Kevin McCrory. He's helping me sort through the archives to make this Radio Times Rewind series. Hi, Kevin. Nice to talk to you again.
Great to be here, Marty. How are you?
I'm good.
What struck you listening back to this interview with Salman Rushdie?
Well, so many things. And I'll confess up front, he's really one of my favorite interviews. And I interviewed him a bunch of times over the years. First of all, he's fun to talk to. He has a wonderful sense of humor. He's a great conversationalist. And I will also confess up front that I love Joseph Anton, that book. I struggle through some of his novels to put an interview together, but I figured it was going to be worth it. Didn't always connect with what he was writing, but just every time I knew he was coming to Philly, it's like, yeah, let's get him on the show.
What's so interesting about him is he's become like so much more than his books, right? Yeah. Like he's become this symbol almost for like free expression and, you know, the idea that you should be able to be creative and write what you want. And, you know, people might be offended, but that's fine.
I mean, it's a very current discussion, and he talked about the culture of offendedness, which I thought was an interesting way of putting it. And he's, you know, having written this very controversial book, I mean, he believes, as he says, put it all out there and we will deal with it, you know, one way or the other.
I was kind of struck by, okay, so this was a conversation you had in 2013 and like him talking about like the culture of the internet and this culture of offendedness and identity politics. I was like, in my mind, 2013 seems like so long ago and like quaint, but like those issues that are so resonant now were very much part of the conversation then, too.
Indeed. And it is interesting to feel as if, not that history is repeating itself, but that we haven't really resolved, I mean, this very critical issue about at what point is something worth censoring or not. And he obviously embodies that.
Was that, I guess, part of why you wanted to interview him to begin with? Just like that whole mystique of here was a guy who became internationally known as a target based on just something he wrote.
Yes, yes. And to be honest with you, and I think this is one of the, I don't know if joke is the exact word, many people say, no one read the Satanic Verses. And, you know, half the world was opposed to it. He does describe, though, and this is to talk about the importance of what he was doing, but also the danger. I mean, people were, bookstore owners were attacked. I mean, people were hurt by this book. He wrote it, you know, so he is a sort of responsible to some degree about creating this environment.
At least one person died.
Yeah.
Despite all of that, it's interesting how much of a sense of humor he has. And he's so funny, right?
Yeah, like, he's so funny.
If you didn't know him or you didn't listen to the interview, you would think, oh, he's so serious. But you guys had a really great time. It seemed chopping it up a little bit.
Yeah, we were chopping it up a little bit. I mean, part of that is that over the years, I'm not saying I got to know him, but I got to know the public him. So I knew that there was humor in there. And even Joseph Anton has those moments of, this is like this crazy world that I'm living in, but obviously got to figure out how to make the most of it. But yeah, very charming, lovely sense of humor.
And of course, in 2013, you really got the sense that he kind of was comfortable and felt like maybe this whole fatwa thing was in the past. Of course, we see how that ended up playing out in 2022. But I thought it was worth playing a clip from his appearance on Curb Your Enthusiasm in 2017, which just kind of further speaks to how comfortable he was and how willing he was to kind of like have a sense of humor about all of this. So let's hear that clip of him and Larry David. And the setup here is that in this season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, essentially Larry writes a play about Salman Rushdie, and then he goes on the Jimmy Kimmel show and like makes fun of the Ayatollah. And then based on him making fun of the Ayatollah, he gets a fatwa put on himself. So then he shows up at Salman Rushdie's house like in this ridiculous disguise, kind of asking for advice.
Yes.
You are a dangerous man. There are very beautiful women who like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Even with me, they would like it?
It's not exactly you. It's the fatwa wrapped around you, like kind of sexy pixie dust. But you look like a person trying to hide.
That's exactly right.
That is not sexy. Be a man, stop this, and fatwa sex will follow.
Fatwa sex?
The best sex there is.
Wow.
Yes.
So good. So Curb.
Right. I mean, like, what an amazing sense of humor he has about this whole thing. And of course, Larry David's genius just kind of shines through there.
And apparently he married a lot of really beautiful women. This would be Salman Rushdie. Yes. Let me just say, because I did not interview him after he was attacked, and he was attacked, nearly killed at Chautauqua. He was being interviewed on the stage, and a guy stormed the stage with a knife and just shredded his eye and nearly killed him. He wrote a book about it called Knife, which I read a couple of months ago. It's really powerful, almost like a autopsy, if I can use that word, of what happened and what it was like to be him. It's also a love story. He falls in love with this wonderful woman who takes care of him. So he's married again and, you know, has a kind of happy ending that way.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Let's hear a clip of him. After that book, Knife, came out, he did several interviews, including with 60 Minutes. And this is him talking with Anderson Cooper.
It felt like something coming out of the distant past and trying to drag me back in time, if you like, back into that distant past, in order to kill me. I do feel that it has left a shadow. And I think that shadow is just there. You know, and some days it's dark and some days it's not.
You feel less than you were before?
No, I just feel more the presence of death.
Mm. Powerful, powerful stuff. I should add that the man who tried to kill him was convicted to 25 to life just a month or two ago.
Yeah. And you just think, wow, this person has had to live in this shadow for so long in their life, and it caught up to them in this really horrific way.
Yeah.
And I hope that he still has the sense of humor that he had in 2013 when you talked to him.
I don't know the answer to that. It is tough. I mean, obviously, to be so horrendously attacked. But as I said, he survived, put himself back together, wrote this incredible book, Knife, which I do recommend if for those that want to understand what that was like for Salman Rushdie. Radio Times Rewind is a WHYY special series on Sunday evenings, and you can always download a podcast of the interviews wherever you get your podcasts. Kevin McCrory and I are the executive producers of the show. Our engineer is Al Banks. Next Sunday, my 2003 interview with Toni Morrison.
If you know anything, you pass on the knowledge. And if you have anything, if you have any excess, you share it with somebody.